Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This podcast extra was originally recorded December 2018 at the home of Robert and Nena Thurman.
So anyway, Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Solar New Year, Roman New Year. And later, happy Tibetan New Year on February 5th. And so this is a Happy New Year and Happy Christmas time. Now, I read a very interesting editorial in the New York Times this last Sunday, because it's only December 5th now. We're looking forward. December 4th, actually, today. And there was a very nice Jewish writer writing about how he was embarrassed about Hanukkah, even though today I think it's the third day of Hanukkah. And my dear friend Paul was lighting third candle, I think, today in the menorah. And I love the menorah tradition. But anyway, he was saying he doesn't like Hanukkah because Hanukkah celebrates the Maccabees, who were kind of like fundamentalist Jews, you know, going against the Hellenized Jews, who are a little more relaxed and pluralistic and not so rigid, you know, about their belief system. And Heath considers himself a Hellenized Jew, although Americanized, you know, this guy who was writing. So he's unhappy to celebrate the triumph of the fundamentalists over the more pluralistic, relaxed ones. He wrote. I didn't know all that. I thought it was quite fascinating. I'm learning so many things in my old age, like about how the Hasidics think the earth is sacred and the earth is made of God and it's not nothing. And therefore they're more environmentally and they're more joyful on earth than more Orthodox people. You know, I think that's really cute. I only learned that recently too. Somebody even questioned it. Oh, that can't be so. You know, they were saying from whatever they knew about Hasidics. But I think it is so. So anyway, the source I read was impeccable, I believe. And so I thought that's very cute. The Tibetans, we have our own candle festival, which always comes around this solstice time also, which is a candle lighting for Lama Tsongkhapa, who in 1419, 599 years ago, left his coarse body, as they would say, because he was a yogi who understood life and death and death and life. And so he left a coarse body consciously at the age of 62, a relatively short lifespan in the high altitude Tibet. And then appeared in a subtle body form, in a youthful subtle body form, in consort with a female partner, yogic partner, showing the male-female union type of Buddhahood, of esoteric teaching, in a glorious radiant vision. All of his attending disciples saw that, they report, you know, in the biographies. And so in honor of that wonderful thing, and he could have done that if he had resigned as a monk in 1398, when he attained a very high level of enlightenment. He could have done that bodily, what they would think of as a bodily enlightenment as well. But he didn't, because he wanted to keep the monk's vow, not having the partner, you know, until to set an example for the other Tibetans, which was very self-restrained and wonderful of him. For 21 years he did that. So we have another candlelighting thing. So then, in this article, this great writer, I'm sorry I can't remember his name, he was saying how he does Hanukkah to fend off his daughter, 5-year-old or something, who was wanting Santa. And he couldn't provide Santa, you know, because he was thinking, as Jewish, because he's Jewish, that Santa is some sort of Christmas thing. But, you know, that's totally not correct, actually. He didn't get into that, but I know that. Santa is really a pagan thing. You know, neither Jewish nor Christian, but it's basically the idea of the return of fertility, prosperity, the anticipation eventually of spring by reaching the shortest day in the Northern Hemisphere and then beginning to have longer days and the rising of the light, you know, the sort of death of the light and the rebirth of the light. And that's why Christmas is on that around that time always in the solar calendar. And in the lunar calendar, Tsongkhapa's thing, 25th day of the 10th lunar month is usually around the time of the solstice. And so Hanukkah fits with that time. But then I was wondering, and then I wanted to say to you, why is it that he can't have Santa? Now, I've been in the same position, being a Buddhist, sort of half-baked Buddhist that I am, in that our kids, they wanted Santa. Where's Santa? Where's Christmas, you know? And also everybody likes baby Jesus, whether you're Christian or not, and whether he's the Messiah. If you don't think he's the Messiah, if you're Jewish, he's just a prophet or he's a nice rabbi. And that, you should just see him as a nice rabbi and not get all upset about it. And celebrate his birth. He did a great job, you know. He showed that he couldn't be killed by a bunch of crappy Romans. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But they didn't do that. So the point is, why doesn't he let his daughter have a Santa, have a Jewish Santa? Who cares? In the Buddhists, we have someone called Vaishravana, who is considered the guardian king of the north, a deity in India, but they could think of it as an angel in one of the monotheistic traditions without any sweat. And he's associated with wealth and gifts and presents and generosity. He lives in a giant jewel palace, and he has horsemen who distribute jewels all over the place. He doesn't have reindeer, but he's kind of like a Vaishravana figure for Buddhists in Japan and China and Korea and Tibet and in India in the ancient time. And so that's like Santa. So then what we used to do is we used to talk about the Tibetan New Year, where the Buddha made miracles for 2 weeks at the Lunar New Year to sort of show his miraculous abilities, which normally he hid. You know, and it's against the rules in the Buddhist monk order or mendicant order to show off if you have supernormal powers. I never say supernatural, supernormal. But he did do that this 1-2 week period toward the end of his life to just kind of leave a hint to the people and to posterity that if you attain full and perfect enlightenment, you really can shape the material world, which you wouldn't do for your own pleasure because you have total pleasure just to start with. If you're enlightened, fully enlightened, but Buddha, you're made of pleasure. You realize that all beings and all life is made of pleasure, of joy, of bliss, you know. So you don't need any more. But you might want to rearrange things for the benefit of those who are suffering, to get them to open up to their true deeper nature, where they'll be more gentle and more happy and more fulfilled, you know, which is a great teacher, a great prophet. That's what they're all trying to do. God is trying to do that too, in all of those monotheistic ideas, you know. So, point is, that's what the Tibetans celebrate, sort of that magical thing, and they make gifts, and they do, you know, in the Losar. So all of it all has to do with a kind of ancient, cyclical, calendrical celebration of death and rebirth, right? Because the sun dies and gets to its shortest day in the Northern Hemisphere on December 21st or 2nd, and then it starts to grow again, you know, up to the summer solstice, where it's the night is pretty much suppressed, you know. And then when you're near the poles, you have the all day, the summer night, the midsummer night, and then you have all dark winter, you know, when you get nearer the pole. And you have the opposite time of year in the southern hemisphere, right? So that's what it's all about. It's not some sort of religious sectarian thing in any case. And of course, if you're Jewish, you don't celebrate Jesus as the Messiah. And you shouldn't, because you don't believe that he is. You see him as a Messiah, maybe, or a prophet. The Muslims see him as a great prophet within the line from all the way back to Moses, and they accept him as that, but not the way the Christians do. But still, they still like him. And there's a lot. I have Jewish colleagues, academics, and they write books like Rabbi Jesus, you know, and Rabbi Hillel, for example, I believe was in the first century of the Common Era. First CE century, and he taught just like Jesus about altruism and self-sacrifice, self-transcendence, and all this sort of thing. And Judaism is about that anyway. So, you know, I wish that guy, I'd like to write him an op-ed myself, that to be... I really like the New York Times nowadays. You know, Michelle Alexander of Mass Incarceration, the new Jim Crow book, Fame, wonderful lady. I'd like to get her on my podcast. But by the way, I wish she would join me. I admire her so much. I'd like to talk to her about her op-ed, where she was so frustrated with the elite of our country that they won't really share. They won't let people out of jail who are unjustly put there. They won't do climate change to fix the planet. You know, they're just grubbing ahead, grabbing whatever they can grab. And they think that being in politics and being a political leader means you can rip people off legally, rather than it means that you're supposed to serve people and do public service, which is what it's supposed to mean. And she was so frustrated that she said, I wonder if they would behave better if they felt they were going to be reborn in the same environment, instead of this idea that I'm going to live it up to the hilt and suck whatever I can out of it all and then die and be nothing, but I've had like a wild ride in between. Which is a kind of psycho behavior of the elite of our culture, which I totally agree with her. So, and she writes, what if there was reincarnation? Although she says she doesn't think so. But in case there was, wouldn't it be better? She's kind of saying, you know, if people knew that, you know. Well, the Buddhist ethical and biological theory of the karma, as I've told you all here many times, they definitely say we are going to be back here or in some environment. And the environment is going to give us feedback of how what we've dished out into it. And therefore, there's long-term consequence of what you do. And so much so, and I make it such an emphasis of that, that one of my editors once said, my book called Infinite Life, which is a book I really like, that I shouldn't call it Infinite Life, I should call it Infinite Consequences. So at the time I said, well, she could leave that title to John Ashcroft. Or Jeffrey Sessions, I could say nowadays, and until recently. And I was not emphasizing that, I was emphasizing infinite life. But infinite life means you have infinite consequences of what you do right now in this moment. So it means that this moment connects to eternity. So that gives you even more incentive to make this moment awesome. Because you definitely want awesome eternity. If you're stuck here for eternity, you don't want to suffer. You don't want to make others suffer because they'll end up making you suffer. And also, it's not nice for them to suffer. If you're happy, you don't need other people suffering around you. No way. So, anyway, so happy Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year, Losar, Gandengamche, whatever kind of celebration you're doing about the death and the rebirth of the light, showing that light cannot be destroyed. That's what this is all about. So every kid can have a Santa, candy cane, Hanukkah, presents for 8 days, whatever they like they can have, you know, because their poor things are facing a long life of struggle, and that they have some great Christmases type of things, Hanukkah type of things, Losar type of things is very important for them, to encourage them to face it, you know. And in the Buddhist tradition, we can encourage them, they can be truly blissful permanently and use the human life to achieve a really steady and reliable trajectory toward that. And they can do that without having to be a religiously nominal Buddhist, by developing their mind, their heart, their body, their love, their compassion, their learning, their insight into the nature of reality. They can find out that reality makes that impossible for them, realistically. And that you can find out, you can interpret God as giving you that. If you're a monotheist, you can make a determination that God, and you can change the theologies from horrible, sadistic ones that make God always deny you satisfaction and elevate cruelty, you know, demonstrate cruelty, which you then elevate in a culture. These are cruel, bad, you know, misunderstandings of monotheism, even, I would say. I would argue. So people can keep their religious traditions and just interpret them in such a way as to be more realistic and more scientific. And in doing so, then we will get away from any of these, like, authoritarian, militaristic, violent cultures that make people miserable, that encourage cruelty and violence and make them unhappy. So this is what we are celebrating. The miracle of this time is the time that the good guys, the gentle people, the loving people are more powerful than the cruel, bad, violent, nasty guys and or girls. And so that's what we celebrate. And we renew our hope and our encouragement for that enterprise in whatever cultural and religious terms we put it. You know, pluralism doesn't mean you allow all negative views of some other tradition. Like, for example, if somebody interpreted Christianity as meaning they should go out and kill every non-Christian, that is not acceptable under religious pluralism, because it's so unpluralistic and it's actually lethal and dangerous. Similarly, if they interpreted Islam or Buddhism or Hinduism or Confucianism or communism like that, that anybody who does, or capitalism, anybody who doesn't share their ideology or religious worldview should be worse than human and therefore subject to being put to death and treated cruelly and oppressed. This is just totally wrong. And that's not a matter of, that's not allowing, and that is a question of not allowing insane people to run around hurting themselves and others. It's not a question of not being religiously pluralistic. You know, when people overinterpret pluralism in the wrong way, as to think that whatever somebody else claims is religion, they can then get away with. Like a big con job organization like Scientology, for example. Oh yeah, we're a religion, so we don't pay taxes and you can't tell us what we can do. Well, they're conning people out of their money. And they're pretending that holding these electric things, they're getting all enlightened, which is all nonsense. Although as a community, any community can have some benefits to its members. So it's not all black and white, or white and black. But that's really an important thing to remember. So we're celebrating the rebirth of joy, the rebirth of love, gentleness, sweetness, compassion. That's what we're celebrating at this holiday time, and that's why we call it a holy day. Okay? And everyone can do it in their own way, and we can really have a great time doing it. So that's what I'm wishing you here to do. Now, what we do at our Menla, our Medicine Master Buddha Mountain retreat, is we do this at Solar New Year. And we have a four-day thing, and my beloved colleague, Sharon Salzberg, one of the great meditation if not the greatest meditation teacher of her generation and our generation. Maybe she's younger than me. Maybe it's not quite my generation. Maybe I'm too old. I don't know. But she's just the greatest. And she always comes very graciously to Menla. And we teach together with a kind of combined sort of Buddhist level, but again, in the way we do at Menla, where it's not religious, you don't have to be Buddhist at all. It's a Buddhist. We have Buddhism, not Buddhism there. And we have a wonderful time rekindling hope for the new year, which is what we do then at the new year as well, even though we're already 8-9 days into the growing of the light, past the death of the light on the 21st of December. So that's really important. And then I also want to invite everybody to our great Nguyen Lem concert in February 5th, this coming 2019 year of the pig, year of the earth pig. And I want everyone to come because we have to pray for His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who will be 84, and therefore it's in his own pig year, because he was born in the pig year 1935. And that's supposed to, when you're in your own year, every 12 years, you have to be very careful not to run into any obstacles. And so if someone you love is in their obstacle year, as the Tibetans call it, when their own birth year comes up, You have to. They have to do something special. You do special things for them. You pray for them. You try to like take away obstacles from them on yourself or whatever. However you do it. So we have to think about that, about the wonderful being, the Dalai Lama, on this New Year's on February 5th. And what we did there was that Tsongkhapa, in 1409, established this as a tradition in Lhasa, Tibet, capital of Tibet, where for 2 weeks, everybody goes on vacation. No businesses were functioning, nothing except basic, you know, life services. And the spiritual people take over the management of the, they become sheriff, you know, for a fortnight from the new moon to the full moon of the first lunar month. And they celebrate the 2 weeks of the miracles that Shakyamuni Buddha did in the New Year in India, in the Lunar New Year, where he did things like, and this is the Christmas tree, that's right, that's how I got this. And this is the Christmas tree. So one of the first miracles he did, when some king offered him a fruit or some meal, he ate it, and then he was given a toothpick as a Indian tradition, I guess, after a meal, you give the visitor a toothpick. And he used it to clean his teeth. But then he took the toothpick and he planted it in the ground. He chucked it in the ground like that. And it suddenly sprouted into a giant tree with growing, instead of fruits, jewels. Like a jeweled, like with Christmas ornaments tree, like a jeweled Christmas tree. So this is what we used in my family to simulate Christmas for our daughters, although we were neither going to a church nor a synagogue or anything like that. And even we didn't even probably have a proper Buddhist temple because we lived in a regular town, you know, in America. And so that was the Christmas tree. And then this tree had an amazing property, which was it then radiated light to the thousands of people assembled in this particular set of miracle contests that the Buddha was in these 2 weeks. And the light came out of the jewels hanging on the jewel Christmas tree, jewel Buddha tree, toothpick tree, magical tree. And then when the light was seen by the people, they temporarily became clairvoyant. And they became also aware that their own thoughts became readable by others around them. So everybody was reading everybody else's mind, in other words, by the blessing of this light. And therefore, everybody became extremely mindful about what they were thinking. Because if you had a negative thought about someone, neighbor, or that guy, something like that, then it became audible to the other people and they would look at you. So then you were really trying to control and think only positive thoughts. And then when they were in that mindful focus, the Buddha gave a 2 or 3 hour teaching to them about how to purify your mind. You know. So his miracle always had a kind of output, like a piece of performance art or something the Buddha did in these stories. I mean, you don't have to even believe the stories if you don't need to, if you're into materialism and you think no one can do miracles. It's just called it a literary miracle. But the point is a piece of performance art, getting the people receptive to then listen to a teaching. And the teaching is in order to get them to deepen their understanding of reality themselves, what they are. That they're actually happier than they think they are. And they have more blessings than they know they have. That's what a teacher is trying to do. Not trying to make them start, enter some fantasy world, unrealistic fantasy world somewhere else, based on some authority. It's trying to actually help them open their critical mind and open their deeper, more penetrating insight so they can be more aware of what reality is, in fact. Because why does Buddha want them to do that? Because Buddha discovered that reality is great. Reality has everything we need in it already, if we knew how to access it, if we understood that. What we don't, by not understanding that, we don't look for it. We look elsewhere, where we look in all the wrong, looking for love in all the wrong places. As somebody said, I forgot who did, Eddie Murphy maybe. Okay, so that's it. That's my New Year's greeting. And I'm promoting Menla's weekend from the 27th, I think, to January 1st, December 27th, January 1st. Wonderful time we're going to have there. Just join up. We already have lots of people, but I think there's more room. And then second, the concert, which usually does really well, sells out Carnegie Hall. People just come for the blessing and the music. And there we celebrate the possibility of the miraculous. And nowadays we're all having a hard time. And by the way, that's just one other kind of realistic thing. I'm very upset with Wisconsin and the awful Scott Walker, who just got kicked out as governor. But they unfortunately, but probably because of vote suppression and cheating by the Republicans in charge up until the election, the legislatures of Wisconsin is still in Republican hands. And so what they're doing is like what they did in North Carolina when Roy Cooper won the Democratic governorship after a long monopoly by Republicans, is they tried to pass all kinds of crazy laws preventing the new governor from fixing any of the mess they had made of the state's education system and other things, and unions and working men and women, a total mess. People get in government, that kind of people get in government, and then they think this, now I can rob everybody legally. Before I just did it as a businessman or some other kind of shady person, as a ruthless businessman, but now I can rob them as a ruler, a governor. I can take bribes, I can channel money toward companies that are paying me off in some other way, even if I don't openly take bribes or whatever. You know, they just think government service means serving yourself at the expense of the people, which is not what government service is. Government service is you serve the people. You know, you have noblesse oblige. You adopt that element of kingship, good side. You have a sense of noblesse oblige toward the people. And you do things for them, and you sacrifice yourself, actually. That's what kingship, that's what being a leader is about. Not about robbing people and suborning them. Terrible, really. So everyone should be alert to any of these places that were turned around, away from the nasty, fear-mongering bunch of self-centered people, to people who would have some vision, at least, of trying to be sensible. And yet they're trying to cripple them ahead of time in the lame duck sessions everywhere. So people should be aware of that and be up against it. Don't think just because you voted that it's over. You go up and like make a protest and write a letter and call them on the phone and don't allow this. And this is a great way of keeping your joy up in the holiday. You know, there's a wonderful book by Alice Walker, another of my heroes, called The Secret of Joy. And she writes in the big final punchline of that really horrifying but beautiful novel, with which I still dream of making a movie one day. And that is possessing the secret of joy. What is the secret of joy? It is resistance. That's what it is. In other words, if you're getting suppressed, you're not going to be joyful. But if you resist, even if you're not right away successful, then you find your joy again. Because you come back to life, you know, and life is joy, you know. So it's joyful. It's not a strain or horrible to do. It might be a little scary if you're timid to speak truth to power, but actually it brings joy is what it does. And that we should know, okay? So by being happy, you're resisting. That's a key thing. Being happy, you're resisting. You know, I was just reading a beautiful thing in the recent New Yorker, which published some old articles from past decades, which are so beautiful. What a wonderful institution that New Yorker is. And what they did was, James Baldwin, I read an essay of his, and what a powerful thing, the way he understood it, and what he understood, the cruelty of white people to black people, the way he expressed it was deeply touching and moving, you know. And we all should read more of his works, really. And But the great thing that he's noticed was, which in a way shows his compassion as a person and as a writer, that the cruelty by the white people on the black people, which was even worse then as now, but it still goes on, really, and so it's still worse in a way, you could say. It's never unworse until it's totally not worse. You don't have degrees of worse, really. But the point is that they do that because they're unhappy. Because they feel insufficient, they feel cramped, so that makes people cruel when they're unhappy. And he recognized that. So in a way, that was a look of compassion he's giving, even though he's protesting and he's being honest and rigorous. But his protest is from compassion. It's a joyful resistance. That seeing the unhappiness in the oppressor and realizing that's the source of the oppression. It's via ideology, via habit, via upbringing, via what Wilhelm Reich called the emotional plague of the self-suppressed person who then can only get a thrill by suppressing some other people. So therefore, they won't be able to stop the oppressing the other people until somehow they have mercy on themselves, which is a little more complicated, but that's the essence of it, actually. So this, you can learn all about this. Just come join us at Menla, or join your own teacher somewhere, or go see your rabbi, go see your minister, if they're the type who are not uptight, you know. And have a great 2019. The other night I had a dream. And this can be a podcast and also can be put on the Kala Chakra website, our Kala Chakra special learning thing. And I was really pleased having this dream. And I think it was occasioned because a vivid one. It woke me up at 5 in the morning. It's in the pre-dawn time, which is the auspicious time for an important dream. It was multicolored, and it was in New York City, although I was having the dream up here in the mountains. And it was occasioned by having to finish the newsletter for the spring semester, the Tibet House Drum, T-H-U-S, you know, Tibet House U.S., drum. And also by the return of one of my former students, PhD student, and colleagues now, Dr. John Campbell, who is also one of the 12 apostles, can we say, call them, Patabi Joyce, the great yoga master from Mysore, India, the late great yoga master from Mysore, India, Patabi Joyce. And John, during the time he was working for his PhD, he also took around a long time to it because he also would go for long periods of time, 6 months, sometimes a year, whatever, for long training sessions in Hatha Yoga, Ashtanga version by Patabi Joyce in Mysore. And during that time, he would also go over to the Tibetan monasteries in South India, monasteries there, or Dharamsala, received a lot of initiation. So he's really kind of the ideal, and he helped me start the Buddha and the Yogis tradition that we have going now in its 10th, 11th year with Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor. We had Eddie Stern there for a while. We had John there, and he's helped start it. And he's sort of come back to my area from Virginia, and he wants to teach yoga in a little bit of a Vajrayana context, but it's pure Ashtanga yoga for those who want that. And for those who are know yoga well enough and are well enough expert in it to realize that yoga is really a Vajrayana, a tantric, a non-dual practice. It is not really Sankhya yoga type practice. And why am I saying that? And it is, well, I'll go more into that later, maybe. Let me not digress too much right away and say that. In the sense that in Yoga Sutra, Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, there's a half of one verse about asana, about posture, and removing knots in the nervous system of the body. There's really no mention of chakras. And there's, you know, it's defined as chittavritti nirodha, which means the cessation of any functioning of mind. So it's really it's based on the Sankhya philosophy of the dualistic vision of the universe, that the world of embodiment, of relationality, is suffering, just like Theravada Buddhism, which the Yoga Sutra is contemporaneous with. And that the yogin's job is getting out of the relative world and getting away from the body, which is a source of suffering, and ceasing the function of mind, chitta, and going into samadhi going to Nirvikalpa Samadhi sort of type definition, which means a state outside the world, like the Theravada and Mahasanghika yogis of the Buddhist persuasion who feel that nirvana is outside of samsara and don't think samsara can be turned into some sort of a nirvanic experience. So, whereas the yoga, hatha yoga, ha and ta, I believe, and don't ask me which is which, are the right and left channels of the subtle nervous system. And the work of the Richard Sanderson pupil, Sir James Mallinson in England, and in a way, Alexis Sanderson himself, a famous Oxford scholar, he wants to ground Hatha Yoga in Shaivite Tantra, which, and Tantra is entirely based on the non-dual vision that this world, if properly experienced by body as well as mind, is a world of bliss. And it is nirvana, it is, samadhi, it is, in Buddhist language, bliss void indivisible. And opening up the subtle nervous system in the body, removing the knots of the circulation of the bliss energy in the body, is the job of Hatha Yoga. That's what Hatha Yoga is about. So therefore, either Vajrayana or Shaiva Tantrayana are really the two main things for Hatha Yogins once they really learn about it. And it doesn't mean you have to be a Hindu to do yoga, or a Buddhist, of course. But it means that doing yoga, you are, for whatever reason, considering the body to not be something you escape from, but considering the body to be something you learn to master and to enjoy life through it. It's an instrument of enjoying the good life. And in a way, you could say secularists who do yoga are in a way non-dual also, although unfortunately their non-duality is collapsing mind into materiality, into material. But nevertheless, they feel the body is all they are, and they also feel it has a terminal moment at death, and it just starts at birth, and then your mind occupies it when you grow up a little bit and you realize you have a body. But still, in a way, that's non-dual, in that they then want to improve the condition of the body. And they're not trying to get away from the body, in other words. Okay? So, anyway, I had this dream because I was thinking in the Tibet House Spring Program, how could we have a yoga space in New York where people who have Kalachakra initiation, which so many people do, from His Holiness the Dalai Lama or from another great Lama, or another unexcelled yoga tantra initiation, or any kind of yoga tantra Vajrayana initiation, and probably many people who had Shaiva Tantra initiations, and where they can practice yoga in that kind of a context, in a non-dual context. And I realized that we have this great yoga space in the Tibet House, 1,200 square foot room, with usually Tibetan art, spiritual art on the walls, and a chapel with the Shakyamuni Buddha and some of his disciples in it, and a reflection of the text, the speech of the Buddha, and a statue of Maitreya Buddha, future Buddha, very optimistically placed in the front window of that room. And John Campbell was looking for a place to develop a kind of a yoga center. And we already have it. And it's mostly unused on the weekends. So I had a vision of, but then I was feeling shy about it, and there's already a bunch of yoga centers around here and there, and people are doing their yoga. And why, impose on them? They can just come to our Buddha and the Yogis events at Menla, and, we are doing already that in Vajrayana setting there. But then I had this dream, and in the dream, the Tibet House had a big kitchen there, which we don't, but we did in the building that it was in the dream. And many of the great yogis, Ashtanga yogis, all people from the Krishnamacharya yoga lineage were in there. John Campbell was there, Eddie, all of my friends. They were bringing and cooking some kind of great yoga meals some of the former Jiva Mukti people were there, and there were a lot of young people doing yoga, who, you know, really grooving on the idea of mandalas, and doing it in the context of a mandala. And then, of course, Kala Chakra is the one that's so mostly, you know, the wheel of time, or I call it time machine Buddha, God or Buddha in the form of time machine, the time machine being the world, life, the life which is allowing beings the time to evolve into higher modes of awareness and higher modes of experience, higher sensitivity to bliss and life. And it was all happening. They were cooking, people were doing yoga, people were having such great yoga achievement. They were going down the street doing yoga outside, and it was in a little different neighborhood than the actual Tibet House now. It was on 15th Street between 5th and 6th, but very close to that. It was somewhere where there's a diagonal street as well as cross streets, like McDougal Street or Broadway, you know, where the going cross. And I was looking out a window at one point in the dream, and I saw people going down Broadway doing yoga right in the street, who were like part of our space, you know. So then I wrote in the newsletter, Kala Chakra Yoga Space, and that I and John Campbell and others were going to try to create this space for weekend yogis who maybe do evening yoga things during the week, but on the weekends they want to have mini retreats. Not just wait and go up for a 10-day or an 8-day thing up at Menla or something like that, although they might also do that, but right in the city, doing two strong 8-hour yoga days and on off weekends, you know, and making that, and then maybe even mornings. But my wife got excited when I recounted the dream to her. She said, well, they can also come in the mornings in the week. We can have someone there early, and they can come in and do Ashtanga, Mysore system, self-styled yoga there in that setting. So we're creating a yoga space like that. I think it's a really great idea. I mean, you know, when people meet the Buddha in Buddhist history, they may be butcher, baker, candlestick maker, kings, priests. They may work in courtesan houses, you know, like geisha houses, you know, they had an ancient time. They may be male or female, whatever. They would just say, when they meet Buddha, princes and princesses, and they just would meet him. They'd get in the field of Buddha, and they would just say, forget it, I'm dropping out. I just want to meditate with you. I just want to, like, find out a higher way of being a being in the world. And then he, who had somehow super normal barbers, he had the spirit barbers, let's say, because he would say, Ehi Bhikkhu, or Ehi Bhikkhuni, come here, mendicant, monk or nun. And then he would say that to them. They would move toward him, and then their clothing would change. They'd be wearing the monk's robes or the nun's robes. Their hair would be shaved off, kind of magically, and they'd be ordained. That was the ordination. All he did was say, come here, mendicant. You know, because he was so magical, you know, Buddha was. Ehi Bhikkhu, Ehi Bhikkhuni. Actually, he didn't really so much say Ehi Bhikkhuni. And this has been, you know, in other words, he was a little hesitant about the female mendicants for a number of reasons. One, they were enslaved in patriarchal caste system ridden in ancient India, Vedist India, of course. They were bossed around by their parents, by their fathers. When they grew up, then they would be bossed around by the husband, and then they'd be bossed around by the son. And in between, the mother-in-law might give them a hard time. And they did all the cooking and cleaning and planting and whatever. And they were not married out of romance either. They were arranged marriages to benefit the family. So they were pretty much property. So he knew that. And he also knew, so he wasn't being a male chauvinist, in other words. He knew they were vulnerable. But then he also knew they would seek to escape that social status, lowly social status, in droves, in hordes. And this would create a community needing food support and exemptions from the society that the society would be highly unwilling to give to their, like, you know, indentured servants. And he didn't want to jeopardize the whole mendicant community, which was essential, like educational thing, like university, as they became, giving people a chance to kind of drop out of their normal, you know, slots in the caste society, where they had to make war, or they had to make business, or they had to do menial work, or rule the country, or be priests in temples. And but he knew that he just was made a fuss about it to make it a little bit harder for people. And then he did ordain them, and then there was a flood. And it did strain the generosity of the, however, quite wealthy and generous Indian society of the time, which at least allowed mendicants. In China at that time, in Egypt, in Mesopotamia, West Asia, there was no tolerance of some sort of order of monks and nuns, people who did not do productive work, who were exempt from procreation, they were exempt from family duty, they were exempt from tax payment, exempt from military service, exempt from whatever service the rulers wanted, and just seeking their own liberation. This was not really anywhere, and nowhere but India. For about 300 or 400 years did this happen, and then it slowly happened in a Buddhist version in China and in a Christian version in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and then later in all throughout the Mediterranean area. So even today, having a monastery and people getting free lunch, no free lunch is an American slogan, even. And even in China, the monks there realized that the free lunch was really not part of the Confucian compact in Chinese society. And so they allowed the monks to work and to make gardening and so forth to feed themselves, which was not Buddha's original idea at all, and was not the case in India. So, but the other reason is that Buddha realized that women in general are more close to enlightenment in the human form than men. They're less inclined to violence. They're less inclined to greed, actually, although monks made a big fuss about all women are so lusty, but actually it's because the monks were lusty. And they were desiring dates with women, although they couldn't have them because they had a vow of celibacy. So they projected their own lust on women, whereas women actually are more controlled about it, because, of course, they have to deal with the results, which are a lot of work taking care of the first bearing the child, carrying it around, then giving birth to it, then taking care of it for years and years, you know. So they're a little more realistic about it, and they're actually more near enlightenment. People think men are closer to enlightenment, mostly even Buddhists think that, unenlightenedly, because mostly men were the ones who needed more training, and therefore the Buddha put more effort into them to diminish precisely their greed and their violence and their delusion. And because they dominated society, so they would lead societies in deluded directions, such as war, conquest, overproduction of things, and so on. Whereas women are naturally more interconnected with reality, and they're more realistic in life. And that is the definition of enlightenment. If you only think enlightenment is some bright, powerful idea, you have a light goes off in your head, then men might seem to be in the lead. But if you realize that enlightenment, there are some lights that go off, but what those lead to, true enlightenment, is an awareness of your inter-reality, interconnectedness, your inter-being with all beings and things. And women have that ahead of time. So they're actually more advanced in the compassion, interconnection direction, which is the only reason to become a Buddha. You know, you would try to just escape if enlightenment just meant pop, everything turns into light, and you don't get engaged with the problems of the world. But if you realize enlightenment is solving the problems of the world, then women are solving the daily problems in the families, in the society, in the economy, actually, and in the survival of the species by bringing birth to the beings. They're doing all that work. So they are much more realistic about how to bring that into a positive dimension. And they would be keeping the world much more at peace if the men weren't out there wanting to have their wars and their competitions and their kind of idiot Olympics. Although Olympics, I guess, are a way of avoiding war by having athletic competition, which is good. Sorry, I shouldn't. I just mean the Olympics are good, but idiots participate in them maybe a little bit. So, but it's better than being in war, you know. So anyway, therefore, because of this dream, we want to make a Kala Chakra Yoga space at Tibet House. And we want people to be able to practice yoga and use yoga to liberate themselves while maintaining strength and balance within their lay professions, within their family lives, etc., and just be happier and feel better in the process of doing that. Be also activists and so as lay people are in society, you know, vote, you know, make committees, you know, watchdog on politicians and criminals and things and try to prevent them from misleading the society and so on. So I think this is a great contribution Tibetan can make. I've been doing teachings, lecture teachings kind of, a discussion on meditation teachings called Force for Good, which is kind of showing, focused on how His Holiness the Dalai Lama's great innovations and teachings around the planet, an example around the planet, can help people without them becoming Buddhists, without making it a religious thing even, as a secular thing, help them lead better lives, be happier themselves, and make society better working and happier. And that's what the Force for Good program is. And then, of course, how can we leave out the yoga world? Because actually, where does the yoga world fit in a society? Well, it fits in the area of health, actually, as a basis. It fits between sort of spirituality and health. But spirituality does affect health, actually. Spirituality or lack of spirituality. Spirituality defined not as woo-woo, seeing ghosts, but spirits, you know, but spirituality defined as being focused on love and compassion, seeking the good. You know, that's what, you know, living the good, that's spiritual. You know, as opposed to just accumulating material objects and possessions and dominating material processes and inventing material mechanisms to gain more power for yourself and so forth, which is perhaps tends to be anti-spiritual. Although spiritual, if it's good, also can use the material. It's not against it. Unless you wrongly define the goal of spirituality as simply leaving the world and abandoning the beings in it who suffer to their suffering. And that is not spirituality from the Buddhist point of view anyway. And I think all the great world religious traditions and the indigenous traditions, they do think that spirituality is for the betterment of self and others. And it's basically to decrease selfishness and egotism, egomania, and increase altruism, love, compassion, friendliness, and so forth. I think the ones that have lasted are all basically like that. And when they're used for war, or war against a different religion or something like that, that is really an abuse of the founder's intent. I think it's pretty much clear, you know. You know, in some cases, it's hard to discern because, for example, the peace and light and love that Muhammad, in the case of Islam, that Muhammad insisted on was interrupted by the Meccans, who had a pilgrimage business on a different set of deities, attacking him and trying to kill him and his followers, so he had to defend himself. In the case of the Christians, he was wasted in his after only 4 years of teaching by the political military authorities, the Romans. And he wasn't able to spread the peace and love vision that was the founding movement to his people very widely, therefore, because his teaching time was cut short. So that's the thing. The dream of a Kala Chakra Yoga space on 15th Street between 5th and 6th, and perhaps moving further forward. And I guess, why did I have such a dream? Well, I want the force for good emanating from the Tibetan culture, the Dalai Lama being the supreme product of Tibetan culture, you could say, showing what a human being can become in a way, really, It's not that he's magic or God or something like that. He's like he's a real human, I think you could say. A kind of holy human in that sense. And all humans should be holy. They should be loving. They should be gentle. They should be wise and fair and creative. They should. That's what human beings are capable of. And he really shows that, I think, in his own way. In a context where the world is not like that, so someone to do like that, they have to be... They have the Buddhists create these special institutions, like a monastic type of institution, you know, the institution of being a lama, being a celibate, having a vow of poverty, having a vow of nonviolence, having a vow of chastity, and sort of to live at a special level and thereby set an example to the people. And then the lay people in such a culture where that's a central kind of figure, then their way of ethicality and their way of being more mindful and more aware and more kind and more altruistic gets raised also by having that kind of core curriculum institution in the middle of the society. You know? And Protestantism had a lot of great virtues, there's no question, especially compared to, let's say, corruption of a church institution that is too authoritarian in nature, which is not a peculiar thing for Christianity. All of the religions tend in that direction as institutions. But so that was great about Protestantism. But what is not great about Protestantism is that following the example of Luther, who failed as a monastic to develop meditative poise, to develop meditative attainment, to feel he had purified some of the negative, unconscious, sinful things that he discerned in himself, because, of course, he was a very intelligent person. He then came up with the theory that you can't do that and only you can throw yourself on the mercy of God. But what that led to, and that's a nice idea even if you were a monk, but what that led to was the shutting down of all the monasteries. And the shutting down of the monasteries led to population explosion, excessive militarism, excessive production, industrialism, and actually it was not an unqualified good. Until 50 years ago, people thought it was an unqualified good, just to produce as much and as many things as you can and to have as much war and conquer as much of the planet as you can. Or maybe 100 years ago, they thought that was the greatest, up to the world wars. But since the world wars, that's been diminished in respect, and people realize it's kind of bad. And then particularly since around the time in the 80s, I think it was, or 80s or 90s, where Al Gore wrote the famous Earth in the Balance when he was a senator, when it began to, and the Hansen and others at Columbia University began to notice that climate change, irreversible climate change from the carbonization of the atmosphere, and the temperature raising of the atmosphere was a complete disaster. And so that this this overproduction and over-militarization form of industrial, you know, Protestant ethnic society, capitalist society, was a catastrophe. Going to destroy our whole life world field, Lebenswelt, you know, the environment. And we're not going to have a place to live. We're going to extinguish ourselves as a species, along with the many other species that we're extinguishing. So therefore, there's something unbalanced about it. It's not the ultimate good at all. But unfortunately, leadership, the people on the planet in general, have, I think, come sort of, maybe somewhat subliminally, many of them, but the majority of them have come to realize this. But leadership, those who have used the current imbalance situation to rise into positions of power, they don't want to see change. They're resisting change, and they are not allowing change, actually, therefore, to adapt to the obvious fact that we're driving the planet and human life right off a cliff on this planet. So, yogis, Kalachakra Yogi, Time Machine Yoga, is essential to implement now. And people should be living for a higher purpose while managing the baseline society, baseline industry, baseline relationship to the environment in a proper and realistic way. And the formula for that is already set forth in many wise documents, thousands of years old, not just Buddhists, In a way, Confucius is in the same ballpark. Lao Tzu is in the same ballpark. Isaiah of the Jewish Bible is in the same ballpark. The Greek pre-Socratics and Socrates and Plato are in the same ballpark. Zoroaster for the Iranians was in the same ballpark. You know, there and the Hindu great Upanishadic sages. Everyone was more or less in the same ballpark as the Buddha. But although Arnold Toynbee rightly says that the Buddha was the one who got away with having more of his teaching accepted and respected in the society than any of the others, which probably more had to do with, and that's why, from Buddha's point of view, that's why Buddha chose India to do his mission. But you could also say that's why, you know, the Buddha of Greece, the Buddha of China, had less, was able to do his teaching less fully. And the Buddha of India did, because India was richer, there was more surplus. And ironically, for people to adopt a more spiritual way of living, it is necessary, it's sort of a necessary prerequisite that they attain more wealth, actually, ahead of time. Because once they have wealth, then they realize that the wealth itself is another kind of problem, and it doesn't really solve their deep inner problem. Like Buddha said to his father, when the father said, "You have to be king now," and Buddha said, "No, I'm not king, because there's a contradiction in being a king." And the father said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, as a king, I was educated to take care of the needs of my people." "That's right," says the father, "that's what I do." "Yeah, but you don't, because you maybe you a little bit supervise the economy, you do the defense, you know, you protect them, and you model various kinds of virtuous things for the people. You police evildoers and so forth as well, internally as well as externally. But you don't deal with their death, their sickness, their old age, their inner anxieties, their problem of suffering." And so the father said, "Well, then we leave that to the priests. And that's the job of the gods, you know. And the priests intercede with the gods to try to make the inner life of people better." And Buddha said, "Well, they do a rotten job. They're not accomplishing the mission. So if as I was, you educated me too well, Dad, to take care of the people. And their real problems are these deeper problems. And I have to go, obviously, and become enlightened to be able to take care of those problems." So we now are in this more complicated situation where that example is really important for us. But by being yogis and yoginis of life, not of Hinduism, not of Buddhism, not of Christianity, not of Judaism, and this and that, although we can do all those things insofar as they're part of our different cultures. And we can be, and we can also interpret them in ways where they're not exclusivist, they don't fight with each other. We see the deeper thing being that all of the great spiritual teachers of humanity have emphasized of living from the heart, being more kind and loving, being more sensitive to others, being more altruistic, and being happier, actually, thereby. That's what they're all about. And one can make a path through any of them to do that and make a yoga out of them, not just some sort of card-carrying solution, you know. Not just by having an identity of "I am a such and such," that won't do it. You have to live as such and such, right? You have to imitate Jesus or Moses or Buddha or Lao Tzu or Confucius or Socrates. You have to be a Socrates. It's where yoga, that's what yoga means. Scientists have to be yogis and yoginis because they're a real instrument of knowledge by which they do their math, make their theories, do their experiments, interpret the evidence. All of that is a yoga of their own minds, of their own intelligence. And it's a really important one. And it's not just something done by just writing on a wall, you know. You have to do it with your mind, you know. Even though they, unfortunately, are trapped now into thinking they don't have one. Theoretically speaking, formally speaking. Okay? So that's what I want to talk about. Kala Chakra Yoga and how to bring it into life. You know, when you're waiting in line at the bus station, you know, murmuring to yourself, or if you don't want people to think you're nuts, they might think you were talking on a cell phone if you mumble. But and so that everybody's going around mumbling because they're wearing these earphones and mouthpieces and cell phones. But you don't even have to move your lips. You can just think in your mind, Om Ho Ho Hang Sam Al Radi Aham Pe Om Ho Om Mani Bema Ho Mani Bema Ho Mani Bema Ho Om Dari Tu Dari Tu Dari Swaha. You know, they can just think it in their mind and pronounce it internal pronunciation and turn the wheel of dedication and devotion and mobilization of the loving forces of the universe, wise and loving forces of the universe, even while waiting in a line, waiting at the, you know, to order their food in a restaurant or whatever. Then making life a yoga. In my Infinite Life book, which I'm going to be teaching at Kirpalu, use it as the basis, you know, I have various meditations, like for every transcendent perfection, I have, you know, living, you know, what justice is, for example, ethicality, justice, you know, what is it about? You know, I have a bunch of discursive stuff like that, but then I have meditation of it, you know. And where's the meditation? And the performance of justice. We modern individuals feel a sense of alienation from other beings because our culture teaches us to believe that as separate, independent entities, our lives are finite. We are on our own, and existence is, in essence, futile. We compensate for our feelings of helplessness and alienation by puffing ourselves up with pride. We expend a great deal of psychological energy convincing ourselves that we're the best, because if we weren't, then life would be just too depressing. I'm the only one whom I can count on, we tell ourselves, so I'd better look out for myself and my own interests. End quote. This proud, self-centered attitude is the greatest enemy of compassion. So anyway, that's performing it means. It may seem overwhelming to take on responsibility for all people and all nations of the world. You know, the concept of universal responsibility, one of the Dalai Lama's main great concepts, both through our own personal bodhisattva vows and through our global political agenda. But we must recall that we are not alone in our endeavor. Our meditations on the boundless nature of the self have led us to discover our fundamental connectedness to all life. We are one with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who have traveled this path before us and who are with us even now, so we can draw on their infinite well of positive energy. Also, we can find others in our very real and present human communities who have made a similar commitment to the good of all beings. Together, we can generate a virtuous cycle of positivity, creating an unstoppable wave of compassion that will flow out over all of humanity. Not bad. I like that. So there's a lot of working practices, you know, in this book, and the main one being the infinite life lifestyle. I call it the infinite lifestyle. I call the opposite of that the terminal lifestyle, like a disease. Dis-ease. That's how we normally live, without ease. Whereas the infinite lifestyle is where we are living already in nirvana, and we have an eternity of time in which to more and more fully realize that, and so we can relax and we can try to like see it even in the present in little bits and details.
I'm Gary Gawk, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portals.